Maritime winds, moderated by unfreezing waters of the sea, created a narrow temperate belt at the protected southern tip and provided enough moisture and warmth for the dense hardwood forest of broad-leaf deciduous trees common to cold temperate regions. The cave was in an ideal location. They had the best of both worlds. Temperatures were warmer than any that prevailed in the surrounding area, and there was an abundance of wood to supply fuel for warmth during the freezing winter months. A large sea was close at hand, filled with fish and seafood, and cliffs along the shore were home to a nesting colony of seabirds and their eggs. The temperate forest was a forager's paradise of fruits, nuts, berries, seeds, vegetables, and greens. They had easy access to fresh water from springs and streams. But most important, they were within easy reach of the open steppes, whose extensive grasslands sustained the massive herds of large grazing animals that supplied not only meat, but clothing and implements. The small clan of hunter-gatherers lived off the land, and this land held an overwhelming abundance. Brunn hardly noticed the ground beneath his feet as he walked back to the waiting clan. He couldn't imagine a more perfect cave. The spirits have returned, he thought. Maybe they never left us. Maybe they just wanted us to move to this larger, finer cave. Of course, that must be it. They were tired of the old cave. They wanted a new home, so they made an earthquake to make us leave it. Maybe the people who were killed were needed in the spirit world, and to make up for it, they led us to this new cave. They must have been testing me, testing my leadership. That's why I couldn't decide if we should turn back. Brunn was glad his leadership had not been found wanting. If it hadn't been entirely improper, he would have run back to tell the others. As the three men came into view, there was no need to tell anyone they were through traveling. They knew. Of those waiting, only Issa and Ayla had seen the cave, and only Issa could appreciate it. She had been sure Brunn would claim it. He can't make Ayla leave now, Issa thought. If it hadn't been for her, Brunn would have turned back before we found it. Her totem must be powerful, and lucky, too. She's even lucky for us. Issa looked at the little girl beside her, oblivious to the excitement she had caused. But if she's so lucky, why did she lose her people? Issa shook her head. I'll never understand the ways of the spirits. Brunn was looking at the child, too. As soon as he saw Issa and the girl, he remembered it was Issa who told him about the cave, and she would never have seen it if she hadn't gone after Ayla. The leader had been annoyed when he saw the child wander off by herself. He had told everyone to wait. But if she hadn't been so undisciplined, he would have missed the cave. Why would the spirits lead her to it first? Mogur was right. He's always right. The spirits weren't angered by Issa's compassion, weren't upset that Ayla was with them. If anything, they favored her. Brunn glanced at the deformed man who should have been leader in his place. We're lucky that my brother is our Mogur. Strange, he thought. I haven't thought of him as my brother for a long time, not since we were children. Brunn always used to think of Krebs as his brother when he was young and fighting for the self-control necessary to males of the clan, especially to one destined to be leader. His older sibling had fought his own battle, against pain and ridicule because he couldn't hunt, and he seemed to know when Brunn was close to tears. The crippled man's gentle look had a calming effect even then, and Brunn always felt better when Krebs sat next to him offering the solace of silent understanding. All children born to the same woman were siblings, but only children of the same sex referred to each other with the more intimate term of brother or sister, and then only when they were young or in rare moments of special closeness. Males did not have sisters, as females did not have brothers. Kreb was Brunn's sibling and his brother. Issa was only sibling, and she had no sisters. There was a time when Brunn felt sorry for Kreb, but he had long since forgotten the man's affliction in respect for his knowledge and his power. He had almost ceased seeing him as a man at all, only as the great magician whose sage counsel he often sought. Brunn didn't think his brother ever regretted not being leader. But sometimes he wondered if the cripple ever regretted not having a mate and her children. Women could be trying at times, but they often brought warmth and pleasure to a man's fire. Kreb never had a mate, never learned to hunt, never knew the joys or the responsibilities of normal manhood. But he was Mogur, the Mogur. Brunn knew nothing about magic and little about spirits, but he was leader, and his mate had given birth to a fine son. He glowed with pleasure, thinking of Braud, the boy he was training to take his place someday. I will take him on the next hunt, Brunn suddenly decided, the hunt for the cave feast. That can be his manhood hunt. If he makes his first kill, we can include his manhood rites in the cave ceremony. Wouldn't that make Abra proud? Proud is old enough, and he's strong and brave. A little too headstrong sometimes, but he is learning to control his temper. Brunn needed another hunter. Now that the clan had a cave, they had work ahead of them to prepare for the next winter. The boy was nearly 12, more than old enough for manhood. Proud can share the memories for the first time in the new cave, Brunn thought. They will be especially good. Issa will make the drink. Issa. What am I going to do about Issa? And that girl? Issa's already attached to her, strange as she is. It must be because she's been childless for so long. But she will have one of her own soon, and she has no mate to provide for her now. With the girl, there will be two children to worry about. Issa isn't young anymore, but she is pregnant, and she has her magic and her status, which would bring honor to a man. Maybe one of the hunters would take her as a second woman, if it weren't for that strange one. The strange one that the spirits favor. I might really make them angry if I turn her away now. They might make the earth shake again. Brunn shuddered. I know Issa wants to keep her, and she did tell me about the cave. She deserves to be honored for it, but it must not be obvious. If I let her keep the girl, that would show her honor. But the girl isn't clan. Would the clan spirits want her? She doesn't even have a totem. How can she be allowed to stay with us if she has no totem? Spirits. I don't understand spirits. Kreb, Brunn called. The magician turned at the sound, surprised to hear Brunn address him by his personal name, and limped toward the leader when he signaled that he wanted to talk privately. That girl, the one Issa picked up. You know she is not clan, Mogur. Brunn started, a little unsure of how to begin. Kreb waited. You were the one who said I should allow Ursus to decide if she should live. Well, it looks like he has, but what do we do with her now? She is not clan. She has no totem. Our totems won't even allow someone from another clan at the ceremony to make a cave ready for them. Only those whose spirits will live in it are permitted. She's so young. She'd never survive alone, and you know Issa wants to keep her. But what about the cave ceremony?
Kreb had been hoping for just such an opening. He was prepared.
The child has a totem, Brunn. A strong totem. We just don't know what it is. She was attacked by a cave lion. Yet all she has to show for it are a few scratches.
A cave lion? Few hunters would get away that easy.
Yes, and she wandered alone for a long time. She was near starvation, yet she didn't die. She was put in our path for Issa to find. And don't forget, you didn't prevent it, Brunn. She is young for such an ordeal, Mogur continued. But I think she was being tested by her totem to see if she is worthy. Her totem is not only strong, it's lucky. We could all share her luck. Maybe we already are.
You mean the cave?
It was shown to her first. We were ready to turn back. You led us so close, Brunn.
The spirits led me, Mogur. They wanted a new home.
Yes, of course they led you. But still, they showed the cave to the girl first. I've been thinking, Brunn. There are two babies who don't know what their totems are. I haven't had time. Finding a new cave was more important. I think we should include a totem ceremony for those babies when we sanctify the cave. It would bring them luck and please their mothers.
What does that have to do with the girl?
When I meditate for the totems of the two babies, I will ask for hers, too. If her totem reveals himself to me, she can be included in the ceremony. It wouldn't require much of her, and we can accept her into the clan at the same time. Then there won't be any problem with her staying.
Accept her into the clan? She's not clan. She was born to the others. Who said anything about accepting her into the clan? It wouldn't be allowed. Ursus wouldn't like it. It's never been done before, Brunn objected. I wasn't thinking of making her one of us. I only wondered if the spirits would allow her to live with us until she gets older.
Issa saved her life, Brunn. She carries part of the girl's spirit now. That makes her part clan. She came close to walking in the next world, but she's alive now. That's almost the same as being born again, born to the clan.
Kreb could see the leader setting his jaw against the idea, and he hurried on before Brunn could say anything.
People of one clan join other clans, Brunn. There's nothing unusual about that. There was a time when the young of many clans joined together to make new clans. Remember at the last clan gathering, didn't two small clans decide to join to make one? Both kept dwindling. Not enough children were born, and of those who were, not enough lived past their birth year. Taking someone into a clan isn't new, Kreb reasoned.
It's true, sometimes people of one clan join another. But the girl isn't clan. You don't even know if her totem spirit will talk to you, Mogur. And if it does, how do you know you'll understand it? I can't even understand her. Do you really think you can do it? Discover her totem?
I can only try. I will ask Ursus to help me. Spirits have a language of their own, Brunn. If she is meant to join us, the totem that protects her will make himself understood.
Brunn considered for a moment. But even if you can discover her totem, what hunter will want her? Issa and her baby will be burden enough, and we don't have as many hunters. We lost more than Issa's mate in the earthquake. The son of Grodd's mate was killed, and he was a young, strong hunter. Aga's mate is gone, and she has two children, and her mother was sharing that fire.
A hint of pain touched the leader's eyes at the thought of the deaths in his clan.
And Oga, Brunn continued. First her mother's mate was Gord, and right afterward her mother died in the cave-in. I told Abra to keep the girl with us. Oga is nearly a woman. When she's old enough, I think I will give her to Braud. That should please him.
Brunn mused, distracted for a moment by the thoughts of his other responsibilities.
There are burdens enough for the men who are left, without adding the girl, Mogur. If I accept her into the clan, who can I give Issa to?
Who were you going to give her to until the girl would be old enough to leave us, Brunn?
The one-eyed man asked. Brunn looked uncomfortable, but Kreb continued before Brunn could respond.
There's no need to burden a hunter with Issa or the child, Brunn. I will provide for them.
You?
Why not? They are female. There are no boys to train, at least not yet. Am I not entitled to the Mogur's portion of every hunt? I never claimed it all. I never needed it. But I can. Wouldn't it be easier if all the hunters gave me the full share allotted to Mogur, so I can provide for Issa and the girl, rather than have one hunter burdened with them? I plan to talk to you about setting up my own hearth when we found a new cave anyway, to provide for Issa, unless another man wants her. I've shared a fire with my sibling for many years. It would be difficult for me to change after so long. Besides, Issa helps my arthritis. If her child is a girl, I will take her too. If it is a boy, well, we can worry about it then.
Brunn mulled the idea over in his mind. Yes, why not? It would make it easier on everyone. But why does Kreb want to do it? Issa would take care of his arthritis no matter whose fire she shared. Why does a man his age suddenly want to be bothered with small children? Why would he want to take on the responsibility of training and disciplining a strange girl? Maybe that's it. He feels responsible. Brunn didn't like the idea of taking the girl into his clan. He wished the problem had never come up at all. But he liked even less the idea of having someone live with them who was an outsider, and outside of his control. Perhaps it was best to accept her and train her properly, as a woman should be. It might be easier for the rest of the clan to live with, too. And if Kreb was willing to take them, Brunn couldn't think of any reason not to allow it. Brunn made a gesture of acquiescence.
All right. If you can discover her totem, we'll take her into the clan, Mogur. And they can live at your hearth, at least until Issa has her child.
For the first time in his life, Brunn found himself hoping that an expected child would be a girl rather than a boy. Once the decision was made, Brunn felt a sense of relief. The problem of what to do with Issa had been bothering him, but he had put it aside. He had more important problems to worry about. Kreb's suggestion not only offered a solution to a knotty decision he had to make as leader of the clan, but it solved a much more personal problem as well. Try as he might, ever since the earthquake that killed her mate, he could think of no other alternative than to take Issa and her expected baby, and probably Kreb as well, to his own hearth. He was already responsible for Braud and Abra, and now Oga. The addition of more people would create frictions in the one place he could relax and let down his guard a little. His mate might not have been too happy about it either. Abra got along well enough with his sibling, but at the same fire? Though nothing had ever been said openly, Brunn knew Abra was jealous of Issa's status. Abra was mated to the leader. In most clans, she would have been the highest-ranked woman. But Issa was a medicine woman who could trace her lineage back in an unbroken line of the most respected, prestigious medicine women of the clan. She had status in her own right, not through her mate. When Issa picked up the girl, Brunn thought he'd have to take her in, too. It hadn't occurred to him that Mogur might take responsibility, not only for himself, but for Issa and her children, too. Kreb could not hunt, but Mogur had other resources. With the problem solved, Brunn hurried toward his clan,
who were eagerly awaiting word from their leader to confirm what they had already guessed. He gave the signal.
We travel no more. A cave has been found.
Issa, Krebs said as she was preparing a tea of willow bark for Ayla, I will not be eating tonight.
Issa bowed her head in acknowledgement. She knew he was going to meditate in preparation for the ceremony. He never ate before meditating. The clan was camped beside the stream at the foot of the gentle slope leading to the cave. Not until it had been consecrated by the proper rituals would they move in. Though it would be unpropitious to seem too anxious, each member of the clan found some pretext to get close enough to look inside. Foraging women made a point of searching near the mouth, and men followed the women, ostensibly to watch them. The clan was keyed up, but in a happy mood. The anxiety they had felt ever since the earthquake had vanished. They liked the look of the large new cave. Though it was difficult to see very far inside the dim, unlighted cavern, they could see enough to know it was spacious, much roomier than their former cave. The women pointed with delight at the still pond of spring water just outside. They wouldn't even have to go as far as the stream for water. They looked forward to the cave ceremony, one of the few rituals in which women had their own part, and everyone was anxious to move in. Mogur headed away from the busy campsite. He wanted to find a quiet place where he could think undisturbed. As he walked alongside the swiftly running stream rushing to its meeting with the inland sea, a warm breeze blew from the south again, ruffling his beard. Only a few distant clouds marred the crystal clarity of the late afternoon sky. The undergrowth was thick and lush. He had to pick his way around obstructions, but he hardly noticed, his mind deep in concentration. A noise from the brush nearby brought him up short. This was strange country, and his only defense was his stout walking stick, but in his one powerful hand, it could be a formidable weapon of defense. He held it in readiness, listening to the snorting and grunting coming from the dense underbrush, and the sounds of snapping branches from the direction of moving bushes. Suddenly, an animal burst through the screen of thick growth, its large, powerful body supported by short, stocky legs. Wickedly sharp lower canines protruded like tusks along both sides of its snout. The animal's name came to him, though he had not seen one before. A boar. The wild pig glared belligerently at him, shuffled indecisively, then ignored him, and burrowing his snout into the soft earth, headed back into the brush. Kreb breathed a sigh of relief, then continued downstream. He stopped at a narrow sandy bank, spread out his cloak, put the skull of the cave bear on it, and sat down facing it. He made formalized gestures, asking Ursus for assistance, then cleared his mind of all thoughts except for the babies who needed to know their totems. Children had always intrigued Kreb. Often when he sat in the midst of the clan, apparently lost in thought, he was observing the children without anyone being aware of it. One of the youngsters was a robust, strapping boy, about halfway into his first year, who had howled belligerently at his birth and many times since, especially when he wanted to be fed. From the very first, Borg was always nuzzling his mother, burrowing into her soft breast until he found the nipple and making little grunting noises of pleasure as he nursed. It reminded him, Kreb thought with humor, of the boar he had just seen grunting as he burrowed into the soft earth. The boar was an animal worthy of respect. It was intelligent. The vicious canines could inflict serious damage when the beast was aroused, and the short legs could move with amazing speed when it decided to charge. No hunter would disdain such a totem, and it will be suitable for this new place. Its spirit will rest easy in the new cave. A boar it is, he decided, convinced the boy's totem had shown himself so the magician would be reminded of him. Mogur felt satisfied with the choice and turned his attention to the other baby. Ona, whose mother had lost her mate in the earthquake, had been born not long before the cataclysm. Vorn, her 4-year-old sibling, was the only male around that fire now. Aga will need another mate soon, the magician mused. One who will take Abba, her old mother, too. But that's Brun's worry. It's Ona I need to think about, not her mother. Girls needed gentler totems. They could not be stronger than a male totem, or they would fight off the impregnating essence, and the woman would bear no children. Thought about Issa. Her Sega antelope had been too much for her mate's totem to overcome for many years. Or had it? Mogur often wondered about that. Issa knew more magic than many people realized, and she was not happy with the man to whom she had been given.
This is the end of disc number 2. Please insert disc number 3. This is disc number 3.
Issa knew more magic than many people realized, and she was not happy with the man to whom she had been given. Not that he blamed her in many ways. She had always conducted herself properly, but the strain between them was apparent. Well, the man is gone now, Kreb thought. Mogur will be her provider, if not her mate. As her sibling, Kreb could never mate Issa. It would be against all tradition. But he had long since lost his desire for a mate. Issa was a good companion. She had cooked for him and cared for him for many years, and it might be more pleasant around the hearth now without the constant undertone of animosity. Ayla might make it more so. Kreb felt a flush of gentle warmth, remembering her little arms reaching out to hug him. Later, he said to himself. First, Ona. She was a quiet, contented baby who often stared at him solemnly with her large, round eyes. She watched everything with silent interest, missing nothing, or so it seemed. The picture of an owl flashed in his mind. Too strong? The owl is a hunting bird, he thought, but it only hunts small animals. When a woman had a strong totem, her mates needed to be much stronger. No man with weak protection could mate a woman with an owl totem, but perhaps she will have need of a man with strong protection. An owl, then, he decided. All women need mates with strong totems. Is that why I never took a mate? Kreb thought. How much protection can a roe deer give? Issa's birth totem is stronger. Kreb hadn't thought of the gentle, shy roe deer as his totem for many years. It too inhabited these thick forests, like the boar, he suddenly remembered. The magician was one of the few who had two totems. Kreb's was the roe deer. Mogur's was Ursus. Ursus Spilaeus, the cave bear, massive vegetarian towering over his omnivorous cousins by nearly twice their standing height, with a gigantic shaggy bulk of 3 times their weight, the largest bear ever known, was normally slow to anger. But one nervous she-bear attacked a defenseless, crippled boy who wandered, lost in thought, too close to a young cub. It was the lad's mother who found him, torn and bleeding, his eye ripped away with half his face. And she who nursed him back to health. She amputated his useless, paralyzed arm below the elbow, crushed by the huge creature's enormous strength. Not long afterward, Mogur before him selected the deformed and scarred child as acolyte and told the boy Ursus had chosen him, tested him, and found him worthy, and took his eye as a sign that Kreb was under his protection. His scar should be worn with pride, he was told. They were the mark of his new totem. Ursus never allowed his spirit to be swallowed by a woman to produce a child. The cave bear offered his protection only after testing. Few were chosen. Fewer survived. His eye was a great price to pay, but Kreb was not sorry. He was the Mogur. No magician ever had his power, and that power, Kreb was sure, was given to him by Ursus. And now Mogur asked for his totem's help. Clutching his amulet, he implored the spirit of the great bear to bring forth the spirit of the totem that protected the girl born to the others. This was a true test of his ability, and he wasn't at all sure the message would come through to him. He concentrated on the child and what little he knew of her. She is fearless, he thought. She had been openly affectionate to him, showing fear neither of him nor of the censure of the clan. Rare for a girl. Girls usually hid behind their mothers when he was around. She was curious and learned quickly. A picture started to form in his mind, but he pushed it aside. No, that's not right. She's female. That's not a female totem. He cleared his mind and tried again. But the picture returned. He decided to let it play out. Perhaps it was leading to something else. He envisioned a pride of cave lions lazily warming themselves in the hot summer sun of the open steppes. There were 2 cubs. One was leaping playfully in the tall sear grass, poking her nose curiously into the holes of small rodents and growling in mock attack. It was a she-cub. It was she who would grow into a lioness, the primary hunter of the pride. It was she who would bring her kill to her mate. The cub bounded up to a shaggy-maned male and tried to entice him to play. Fearlessly, she reached up with a paw and batted the adult cat's massive muzzle. It was a gentle touch, almost a caress. The huge lion pushed her down and held her with a heavy paw, then began washing the cub with his long, rough tongue. Cave lions rear their young with affection and discipline, too, he thought. wondering why this scene of feline domestic felicity came to him. Magur tried to clear his mind of the picture, tried once more to concentrate on the girl, but the scene would not shift.
Ursus, he motioned. A cave lion? It can't be. A female cannot have so powerful a totem. What man could she ever mate with?
No man in his clan had a cave lion totem. Not many men in all the clans did. He visualized the tall, skinny child, straight arms and legs, flat face with a large bulging forehead, pale and washed out. Even her eyes were too light. She will be an ugly woman, Mogur thought honestly. What man is likely to want her anyway? The thought of his own repulsiveness crossed his mind, and the way women had avoided him, especially when he was younger. Perhaps she will never mate. She would need the protection of a strong totem if she had to live out her life with no man to protect her. But a cave lion? He tried to remember if there had ever been a woman of the clan with a huge cat for a totem. She is not really clan, he reminded himself, and there was no doubt her protection was strong, or she wouldn't be alive. She would have been killed by that cave lion. Thought crystallized in his mind. The cave lion. It attacked her, but it did not kill. Or did it attack? Was it testing her? Then another thought burst through, and a chill of recognition crept up his spine. All doubt was swept out of his mind. He was sure. Not even Brunken doubted, he thought. The cave lion had marked her with four parallel grooves in her left thigh, scars she would carry for the rest of her life. At a manhood ceremony, when Mogur carved the mark of a young man's totem on his body, the mark for a cave lion was four parallel lines carved into the thigh. On a male, they are marked on the right thigh, but she is female, and the marks are the same. Of course, why hadn't he realized it before? The lion knew it would be difficult for the clan to accept, so he marked her himself, but so clearly no one could mistake it. And he marked her with clan totem marks. The cave lion wanted the clan to know. He wants her to live with us. He took her people, so she would have to live with us. Why? The magician was jarred by a feeling of uneasiness, the same feeling he had experienced after the ceremony the day she was found. If he'd had a concept for it, he would have called it a sense of foreboding, yet tinged with a strange, unnerving hope. Mogur shook it off. Never had a totem come so strongly to him before. That was what unnerved him, he thought. The cave lion is her totem. He chose her, just as Ursus chose me. Mogur looked into the dark, empty eye sockets of the skull in front of him. With profound acceptance, he marveled at the ways of the spirits once they were understood. It was all so clear now. He was relieved and overwhelmed. Why should this small girl have need of such powerful protection? Chapter 5. Black-leafed trees waved and fluttered in the twilight breeze, dancing silhouettes against a darkening sky. The camp was quiet, settling down for the night. By the dim glow of hot coals, Issa checked the contents of several small pouches spread out in orderly rows on her cloak, glancing up now and then in the direction she had seen Kreb leave. She was concerned about him, off by himself in unfamiliar woods, without weapons to defend himself. The child was already asleep, and the woman grew more worried as the daylight waned. Earlier, she had inspected the vegetation growing around the cave, wanting to know the availability of plants to replenish and enlarge her pharmacopoeia. She always carried certain things with her in the otterskin bag, but to her, the small pouches of dried leaves, flowers, roots, seeds, and barks in her medicine bag were only first aid. In the new cave, she would have room for greater quantity and variety. She never went far without her medicine bag, though. It was as much a part of her as her wrap. More, she would have felt naked without her medicines, not without a wrap. Issa finally saw the old magician hobbling back, and relieved, she jumped up to put the food saved for him on the fire to warm, and started water boiling for his favorite herb tea. He shuffled up, then eased himself down by her side as she was putting her small pouches into the larger one.
"How is the child tonight?" he motioned.
"Resting easier. Her pain is nearly gone." "She asked for you," Issa replied. Kreb grunted, inwardly pleased.
"Make an amulet for her in the morning, Issa."
The woman bowed her head in acknowledgement. Then she jumped up again to check the food and water. She had to move. She was so happy she couldn't sit still. Ayla is going to stay.
Kreb must have talked to her totem, Issa thought, her heart beating with excitement. The mothers of the two babies had made amulets that day. They were very obvious about it, so everyone would know their children would learn their totems at the cave ceremony. It presaged good luck for them, and the two women were almost strutting with pride. Was that why Kreb was gone so long? It must have been difficult for him. Issa wondered what Ayla's totem was, but repressed an urge to ask. He wouldn't tell her anyway, and she would find out soon enough. She brought her sibling his food and tea for both of them. They sat quietly together, a comfortable, affectionate warmth between them. When Kreb finished, they were the only ones still awake.
"The hunters will go out in the morning," Kreb said. "If they make a good kill, the ceremony will be the next day. You will be prepared?"
"I checked the bag. There are enough roots. I will be ready," Issa motioned, holding up a small pouch. It was different from the others. The leather had been dyed a deep brownish red, with fine powdered red ochre mixed into the bear fat that had been used to cure the cave bear skin it was made from. No other woman had anything colored the sacred red, although everyone in the clan carried a piece of red ochre in their amulets. It was the holiest relic Issa possessed. "I will purify myself in the morning."
Again, Kreb grunted. It was the usual non-committal comment used by men when responding to a woman.
It carried only enough meaning to indicate the woman had been understood, without acknowledging too much significance in what she said. They remained quiet for a while. Then Kreb put his small tea bowl down and looked at his sibling.
"Mogur will provide for you and the girl, and your child if it is a girl. You will share my fire in the new cave, Issa," he said,
then reached for his staff to help himself up and hobbled to his sleeping place. Issa had started to get up, but sat back down, thunderstruck by his announcement. It was the last thing she expected. With her mate gone, she knew some other man would have to provide for her. She had tried to put thoughts of her fate out of her mind. It made no difference how she felt. Brun would not consult her. But she couldn't help thinking about it sometimes. Of the possible options, some didn't appeal to her, and the rest she thought were unlikely. There was Drug. Since Guv's mother had been killed in the earthquake, he was alone now. Issa respected Drug. He was the best maker of tools in the clan. Any of them could chip flakes from a flint boulder to make a rough hand axe or scraper, but Drug had a real talent for it. He could pre-shape the stone so that the flakes he napped off would have the size and shape he wanted. His knives, scrapers, all his tools were highly prized. If the choice were hers, of all the men in the clan, Issa would choose Drug. He had been good to the acolyte's mother. There had been a genuine fondness in their relationship. It was more likely, though, Issa knew, that Aga would be given to him. Aga was younger, and already the mother of two children. Her son, Vorn, would soon need a hunter to be responsible for his training, and the baby, Ona, needed a man to provide for her until she grew up and made it herself. The toolmaker would probably be willing to take her mother, Abba, too. The old woman needed a place as well as her daughter. Taking on all those responsibilities would make quite a change in the life of the quiet, orderly toolmaker. Aga could be a little difficult at times, and she didn't have the understanding Guv's mother had had. But Guv would be setting up his own hearth soon, and Drug needed a woman. Guv as a mate for her was entirely out of the question. He was too young, just barely a man, and hadn't even made it for the first time. Brun would never give him an old woman, and Issa would feel more like his mother than his mate. Issa had thought about living with Grad and Uka, and the man who had been mated to Grad's mother, Zaug. Grad was a stiff, laconic man, but never cruel, and his loyalty to Brun was beyond question. She wouldn't have minded living with Grad, even though she'd be second woman. But Uka was Abra's sister, and had never quite forgiven Issa her status that had usurped her sibling's place. And since the death of her son, when he had not yet even moved to his own hearth, Uka was grieving and withdrawn. Not even Ovra, her daughter, was able to soften the woman's pain. There's too much unhappiness at that hearth, Issa had thought. She had hardly considered Krug's fire. Ika, his mate, and the mother of Borg, was an open, friendly young woman. That was just the trouble. They were both so young, and Issa had never gotten along very well with Dorv, the old man who had been the mate of Ika's mother, who shared their fire. That left Brun. And she could not even be second woman at his hearth. He was her sibling. Not that it mattered. She had her own status. At least she wasn't like the poor old woman who had finally found her way to the world of the spirits during the earthquake. She had come from another clan.
Her mate had died long before. She never had any children and had been traded off from fire to fire, always a burden. A woman with no status, no value. But the possibility of sharing a hearth with Kreb, of his providing for her, hadn't even entered her mind. There was no one in the clan of whom she was fonder, man or woman. He even likes Ayla, she thought. I'm sure of it. It's a perfect arrangement. Unless I have a boy. A boy needs to live with a man who can train him to be a hunter, and Kreb can't hunt. I could take the medicine to make me lose it, she thought for a moment. Then I could be sure I wouldn't have a boy. She patted her stomach and shook her head. No, it's too late. There could be problems. She realized she wanted the baby, and despite her age, her pregnancy had progressed without difficulty. The chances were good that the child would be normal and healthy, and children were too precious to give up lightly. I will ask my totem again to make the baby a girl. He knows I've wanted a girl all along. I promised I'd take care of myself so the baby he allowed to start would be healthy. If only he'd make it a girl. Issa knew women of her years could have problems, and she ate foods and medicines that were helpful to pregnant women. Though never a mother, the medicine woman knew more about pregnancy, delivery, and nursing than most women. She had helped deliver all the youngsters in the clan, and she dispensed her knowledge with her medication freely to the women. But there was some magic, passed down from mother to daughter, that was so secret, Issa would have died before revealing it, especially to a man. Any man who found out about it would never permit its use. The secret had been kept only because no one, man or woman, asked a medicine woman about her magic. The custom of avoiding direct queries was so long-standing it had become tradition, almost law. She could share her knowledge if someone indicated an interest. But Issa never discussed her special magic, because if a man had thought to ask, she could not have refused to answer. No woman could refuse to answer a man. And it was impossible for people of the clan to lie. Their form of communication, dependent for subtle nuance on barely perceptible changes in expressions, gestures, and postures, made any attempt immediately detectable. They didn't even have a concept for it. The closest they could come to untruth was to refrain from speaking. And that was usually discerned, though often allowed. Issa never mentioned the magic she had learned from her mother, but she had been using it. The magic prevented conception, prevented the spirit of a man's totem from entering her mouth to start a child. It never occurred to the man who had been her mate to ask her why she had not conceived a child. He assumed her totem was too strong for a woman. He often told her so and bemoaned the fact to the other man as the reason his totem's essence was not able to overcome hers. Issa used the plants to prevent conception because she wanted to shame her mate. She wanted the clan and him to think the impregnating element of his totem was too weak to break down the defenses of hers, even though he beat her. The beatings were given, supposedly, to force her totem into submission, but Issa knew he enjoyed it. At first, she hoped her mate would give her to some other man if she produced no children. She hated the strutting braggart, even before she was given to him. And when she found out who her mate was to be, she could do nothing but cling to her mother in desperation. Her mother could offer only consolation. She had no more say in the matter than her daughter. But her mate did not give her away. Issa was medicine woman, the highest ranked woman in the clan, and it gave him a feeling of manliness to have control over her. When the strength of his totem and his manhood was in question because his mate produced no offspring, the physical power he had over her compensated for it. Though the beatings were allowed in the hope that they would result in a child, Issa sensed that Brunn disapproved. She was sure if Brunn had been leader at the time, she would not have been given to that particular man. A man did not prove his manhood, in Brunn's opinion, by overcoming women. Women had no alternative but to submit. It was unworthy of a man to pit himself against a lesser adversary or to allow his emotions to be provoked by a woman. It was a man's duty to command women, to maintain discipline, to hunt and provide, to control his emotions, and to show no sign of pain when he was suffering. A woman might be cuffed if she was lazy or disrespectful, but not in anger and not with joy, only to discipline. Though some men struck women more often than others, few men made a habit of it. Only Issa's mate had made it a regular practice. After Kreb joined their fire, her mate was even more reluctant to give her away. Issa was not only medicine woman, she was the woman who cooked for Mogur. If Issa left his fire, Mogur would too. Her mate had imagined that the rest of the clan thought he was learning secrets from the great magician. In truth, Kreb was never more than properly polite in all the time they shared the same hearth, and hardly deigned to notice the man on many occasions. Especially, Issa was sure, when Kreb noticed a particularly colorful bruise. For all the beatings, Issa continued to make use of her herbal magic. Yet when she found herself pregnant, she resigned herself to her fate. Some spirit had finally overcome both her totem and her magic. Perhaps it was his, but Issa thought if the vital principle of his totem had finally prevailed, why had the spirit deserted him when the cave collapsed? She held out one last hope. She wished for a daughter, a girl to detract from his newly gained esteem, and a girl to carry on her line of medicine women, though she had been ready to end the line with herself rather than have a child while she lived with her mate. If she gave birth to a son, her mate would have been fully vindicated. A girl would still leave something to be desired. Now Issa wanted a girl even more, not to deny her dead mate's posthumous prestige, but to allow her to live with Kreb. Issa put her medicine bag away and crawled into her fur beside the peacefully sleeping child. Ayla must be lucky, Issa thought. There's the new cave, and she's going to be allowed to stay with me, and we're going to share Kreb's fire. Maybe her luck will bring me a daughter, too. Issa put her arm around Ayla and snuggled close to her warm little body. After breakfast the next morning, Issa beckoned to the child and headed upstream. As they walked beside the water, the medicine woman looked for certain plants. After a few moments, Issa saw a clearing on the other side and crossed over. Growing on the open ground were several plants, about a foot high, with dull green leaves attached to long stalks tipped with spikes of small, densely packed green flowers. Issa dug up the red-rooted pigweed and headed for a marshy area beside sluggish backwater and found scouring rush horsetail ferns, and farther upstream, soaproot. Ayla, following her, watched with interest, wishing she could communicate with the woman. Her head was full of questions she couldn't ask. They went back to the campsite, and Ayla watched her fill a tightly woven basket with water and add the stalky ferns and hot rocks from the fire. Ayla squatted beside the woman while Issa cut a circular piece with a sharp flake of stone out of the cloak she had used to carry the girl. Though soft and pliable, the fat-cured leather was tough, but the stone knife cut it with ease. With another stone tool, chipped to a point, Issa pierced several holes around the edge of the circle. Then she twisted tough, stringy bark from a low-growing shrub into a cord and threaded it through the holes and pulled it tight to make a pouch. With a quick flick of her knife, one made by Droog and a tool Issa treasured, she cut off a piece of the long thong that held her wrap closed, first measuring it around Ayla's neck. The entire process took only a few moments. When the water in the cooking basket was bubbling, Issa gathered up the other plant she had collected, along with the watertight wicker bowl, and went back to the stream. They walked along the bank until they came to a place where it eased into the water in a gradual slope. Finding a round stone she could hold easily in her hand, Issa pounded the soap root with water in a saucer-like depression of a large, flattish rock near the stream. The root sudsed into a rich, saponin-filled lather. Taking stone tools and other small items from the folds, Issa unwound the thong and removed her wrap. She slipped her amulet over her head and carefully placed it on top. Ayla was delighted when Issa took her hand and led her into the stream. She loved the water. But after a thorough wetting, the woman picked her up, sat her on the rock, and lathered her from head to foot, including her stringy, matted hair. After dunking her in the cool water, the woman made a motion and squeezed her eyes shut. Ayla didn't understand the motion, but when she mimicked the woman, Issa nodded, and she understood the woman wanted her to close her eyes. The child felt her head being bent forward, then the warm liquid from the bowl of ferns poured over her. Her head had been itching, and Issa had noticed tiny crawling vermin. The woman massaged in the lice-killing liquid extracted from the horsetail fern. After a second rinsing in the cold stream, Issa crushed the pigweed root together with its leaves and lathered it into her hair. A final dunking followed. Then Issa performed the same ablutions on herself while the child played in the water. While they were sitting on the bank, letting the sun dry them, Issa peeled the bark off a twig with her teeth and used it to pull snarls out of their hair as it dried. She was astonished at the fine, silky softness of Ayla's near-white hair. Certainly unusual, Issa thought,
but rather nice. It's really her best feature. She looked at the child without making it obvious. Though suntanned, the child was still lighter than she, and Issa thought the skinny, pale little girl with her light eyes was amazingly unattractive. Unusual-looking people, there's no doubt they're human, but so ugly. Poor child. How will she ever find a mate? If she doesn't mate, how will she have any status? She could be like the old woman who died in the earthquake, Issa thought. If she were my real daughter, then she'd have her own status, too. I wonder if I could teach her some healing magic. That would give her some value. If I have a girl, I could train them both. And if I have a boy, there won't be another woman to carry on my line. The clan will need a new medicine woman someday. If Ayla knew the magic, they might accept her. Some man might even be willing to mate her. She's going to be accepted into the clan. Why can't she be my daughter? Issa already thought of the girl as hers, and her musings planted the germ of an idea. She looked up, noticed the sun was much higher, and realized it was getting late. I must finish her amulet and then prepare to make the drink from the root, Issa said to herself, suddenly remembering her responsibilities. Ayla! She called to the child who had wandered toward the stream again. The girl came running. Looking at her leg, Issa saw the water had softened the scabs, but it was healing well. Hurrying back into her wrap, Issa led the child toward the ridge, stopping first to get her digging stick and the small pouch she had made. She had noticed a ditch of red soil just on the other side of it, near the place they had stopped before Ayla showed them the cave. When they reached it, she poked with her stick until several small chunks of red ochre broke loose. Picking up a few small pieces, she held them out to Ayla. The girl looked at them, not sure what was expected, then tentatively touched one. Issa took the small lump, put it in the pouch, and tucked the pouch in a fold. Before turning to go back, Issa looked out over the view and saw small figures moving across the plains below. The hunters had left early in the morning. Many ages before, men and women, far more primitive than Brun and his five hunters, learned to compete for game with four-legged predators by watching and copying their methods. They saw, for example, how wolves, working together, could bring down prey many times larger and more powerful than themselves. Over time, using tools and weapons rather than claws and fangs, they learned that by cooperating, they too could hunt the large beasts that shared their environment. It prodded them along their evolutionary journey. With a need for silence so as not to warn the game they were stalking, they developed hunting signals that evolved into the more elaborate hand signals and gestures used to communicate other needs and desires. Warning cries changed in pitch and tone to include greater informational content. Though the branch of the tree of man that led to the people of the clan did not include sufficiently developed vocal mechanisms to evolve a full verbal language, it did not impair their ability to hunt. The six men started out at first light. From their vantage point near the ridge, they watched the sun sending its beams ahead of scouts, creep tentatively over the edge of the earth, then blazon forth in full command of the day. Toward the northeast, a vast cloud of soft loess dust shrouded an undulating mass of shaggy brown movement, accented by curving black spikes. A broad trail of trampled earth, entirely devoid of vegetation, followed the slowly moving herd of bison defacing the golden green plains. No longer slowed by women and children, the hunters covered the distance to the steppes quickly. Leaving the foothills behind, they fell into a ground-eating dog trot, approaching the herd downwind. As they drew close, they crouched low in the tall grass, watching the huge beasts. Gigantic hump-backed shoulders, tapering to narrow flanks behind, supported massive woolly heads bearing enormous black horns that spanned well over a yard in mature animals. The rangy, sweaty smell of the close-packed multitude assaulted their nostrils, and the earth vibrated with the movement of thousands of hooves. Brun, holding up a hand to shade his eyes, studied each individual creature that passed, waiting for the right animal in the right circumstances. To look at the man, it was impossible to tell the unbearable tension the leader kept under tight control. Only his pulsing temples above locked jaws betrayed his nervously pounding heart and raw-edged nerves. This was the most important hunt of his life. Not even his first kill that had elevated him to the status of manhood matched this one, for on it rested the final condition for residence in the new cave. A successful hunt would not only bring meat for the feast that would be part of the cave ceremony, but would assure the clan that their totems did, indeed, favor their new home.
If the hunters returned empty-handed from their first hunt, the clan would be required to search further for a cave, more acceptable to their protective spirits. It was their totem's way of warning them that the cave was unlucky. When Brunn saw the huge herd of bison, he was encouraged. They were the embodiment of his own totem. Brunn glanced at his hunters, waiting anxiously for his signal. Waiting was always the hardest part, but a premature move could have disastrous results, and if it was humanly possible, Brunn was going to make sure nothing went wrong with the hunt. He caught the worried expression on Braud's face and almost regretted, for a fleeting moment, his decision to let the son of his mate make the kill. Then he remembered the boy's shining eyes filled with pride when the leader told him to prepare himself for his manhood hunt. It's normal for the boy to be nervous, Brunn thought. It's not only his manhood hunt, the clan's new home may depend on his strong right arm. Braud noticed Brunn's glance and quickly controlled the expression that gave away his inner turmoil. He hadn't realized how huge a living bison was. Standing up straight, the hump at the shoulders of the lumbering beast was a foot or more above his head, or how overpowering a full herd of them could be. He would have to make at least the first telling wound to be credited with the kill. What if I miss? What if I strike wrong and he gets away? Braud's thoughts were in turmoil. Gone was the lad's feeling of superiority, strutting in front of Olga, making practice thrusts while she looked on with adoration. He pretended not to notice. She was only a child, a girl child at that. But it would not be long before she was a woman. Olga might not be a bad mate when she grows up, Braud thought. She'll need a strong hunter to protect her now that both her mother and her mother's maid are gone. Braud liked the way she took special pains to wait on him since she had come to live with him, eagerly running to obey his every wish, even though he wasn't even a man yet. But what will she think of me if I don't make the kill? What if I can't become a man at the cave ceremony? What would Brunn think? What would the whole clan think? What if we have to leave the beautiful new cave already blessed by Ursus? Braud clutched his spear tighter and reached for his amulet in a pleading gesture to the woolly rhinoceros to give him courage and a strong arm. There was little chance of the animal getting away if Brunn could help it. He let the lad think the fate of the clan's new cave rested on him. If he was going to be leader someday, he might as well learn the weight of responsibility of the position now. He would give the boy his chance, but Brunn planned to be nearby to make the kill himself if necessary. He hoped, for the boy's sake, he wouldn't have to. The lad was proud. His humiliation would be great, but the leader had no intention of sacrificing the cave to Braud's pride. Brunn turned back to watching the herd. Shortly, he sighted a young bull straggling away from the throng. The animal was nearly full-grown, but still young and inexperienced. Brunn waited until the bison drifted farther away from the rest, for a moment when he was a solitary creature away from the security of the herd. Then he signaled. The men darted off instantly, fanning out, Braud leading off. Brunn watched as they spaced themselves at regular intervals, anxiously keeping an eye on the straying young bison. He signaled again, and the men sprang toward the herd, yelping and shouting and waving their arms. Startled animals near the edge began to run into the main body of the herd, closing the gaps and nudging the ones near the edge toward the center. At the same time, Brunn dashed between them and the young bull, veering him away. While the frightened beasts at the periphery plowed into the milling multitude, Brunn pounded after the one he had singled out. He poured every ounce of energy into the chase, driving the bull as fast as his thick, muscular legs could move. The dry earth of the steppes filled the air with fine, silty soil, churned up by the horde of hard-hoofed bison as the movement at the edge rippled through the throng. Brunn squinted and coughed, blinded by the swirling dust that clogged his nostrils and choked his breath. Gasping, nearly spent, he saw Grad pick up the chase. The bull veered again at Grad's fresh spurt. The men were moving in, forming a large circle that would bring the beast back to Brunn as he jogged, still panting, to close the circle. The vast herd was in full stampede, charging across the prairie, their unreasoned fear multiplied by the movement itself. Only the young bull was left, running in panic from a creature with a fraction of his strength, but with more than enough intelligence and determination to compensate for the difference. Grad pummeled after him, refusing to give in, though his pounding heart threatened to burst. Sweat made rivulets in the film of dust that covered his body and gave his beard a dun cast. Grad finally stumbled to a halt, just as Drug took his place. The hunter's endurance was great, but the strong young bison pushed ahead with untiring energy. Drug was the tallest man in the clan, his legs a shade longer. Urging the beast forward, Drug bore down on him with a fresh burst of speed, heading him off when he tried to follow the trail of the departing herd. By the time Krug took over from the exhausted Drug, the young animal was visibly winded. Krug was fresh, and he pushed the beast on, forcing a new spurt of energy from the flagging bison with a touch of his sharp spear on the flank. When Goov jumped into the relay, the huge, shaggy creature was slowing. The bull ran blindly, doggedly, followed closely by Goov, constantly prodding him to drain the last drop of strength remaining to the young animal. Braud saw Brun moving in as he let out a yelp and took his turn racing after the massive beast. His sprint was short-lived. The bison had had enough. He slowed, then stopped altogether and refused to move, his hide lathered, his head drooping, his mouth foaming. With his spear held ready, the boy approached the exhausted bull. With a judgment born of experience, Brun made a quick appraisal. Was the lad unusually nervous for a first kill, or over-anxious? Was the beast completely drained? Some wily old bison stopped short of total exhaustion, and a last-minute charge could kill or seriously injure a hunter, especially an inexperienced one. Should he use his bola to trip the animal and knock him down? The brute's head nearly dragged the ground. His heaving sides left no doubt. The bison was spent. If he used his bola, the boy's first kill would have less distinction. Brun decided to allow Braud the full honor. Quickly, before the bison regained his wind, Braud stepped up to the enormous shaggy animal and lifted his spear. With a last-minute thought of his totem, he pulled back and lunged. The long, heavy spear bit deep into the young bull's side. Its fire-hardened point pierced the tough hide and cracked a rib in the swift, fatal thrust. The bison bellowed with pain, turning to gore his attacker even as his legs buckled. Brun saw the motion and jumped to the young man's side and, with the full force of his powerful muscles, crashed his club down on the great head. His blow added impetus to the creature's fall. The bison fell over on his side. His sharp hooves pawed the air in final death throes. Then he lay still. Braud was stunned at first and a little overwhelmed. Then his sharp cry burst into the air as the young man screamed his triumph. He did it. He made his first kill. He was a man. Braud was exultant. He reached for his deeply embedded spear, sticking upright out of the animal's side. Yanking it free, he felt a warm spurt of blood on his face and tasted its salty flavor. Brun clapped Braud on the shoulder, pride in his eyes. "Well done," the jester eloquently said. Brun was glad to add another strong hunter to his ranks, a strong hunter who was his pride and joy, the son of his mate, the son of his heart. The cave was theirs. The ritual ceremony would cement it, but Braud's kill had assured it. The totems were pleased. Braud held up the bloody point of his spear as the rest of the hunters ran toward them, joy in their steps at the sight of the downed beast. Brun's knife was out, ready to slit open the belly and gut the bison before they carried it back to the cave. He removed the liver, cut it into slices, and gave a piece to each hunter. It was the choicest part, reserved for men alone, imparting strength to muscle and eye needed for hunting. Brun cut out the heart of the great shaggy creature, too, and buried it in the ground near the animal, a gift he had promised his totem. Braud chewed the warm, raw liver, his first taste of manhood, and thought his heart would burst with happiness. He would become a man at the ceremony to sanctify the new cave. He would lead the hunt dance. He would join the men in the secret rituals to be held in the small cave. And he would gladly have given his life just to see that look of pride on Brun's face. This was Braud's supreme moment. He anticipated the attention that would be his after his manhood rites at the cave ceremony. He would have all the clan's admiration, all their respect. All their talk would be of him and his great hunting prowess. It would be his night. And Oga's eyes would shine with unspoken devotion and worshipful homage. The men tied the legs of the bison together, well above the knee joints. Grad and Drug bound their spears together. Krug and Goov did the same, making two reinforced poles of the four spears. One was passed between the forelegs, the other between the hind legs, horizontally across the great beast. Brun and Braud stepped to either side of the shaggy head and gripped a horn, leaving one hand free to hold their spears. Grad and Drug each grabbed one end of the pole on each side of the forelegs, while Krug went to the left and Goov to the right of the hind legs. At a signal from their leader, all six men heaved forward, half dragging and half lifting the huge animal along the grassy plains. The journey back to the cave took much longer than the trip out. The men, for all their strength, strained under the load as they skidded the bison across the steps and up the foothills. Oka was watching for them and saw the returning hunters far down on the plains below. When they neared the ridge, the clan was waiting for them and trooped out to accompany the hunters the last part of the way back to the cave.